We have two cases this morning. The first is number 20-2493, United States v. Mitchell, Messrs. Goldberger and Zosmer. And welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you. Good to be with
you. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Goldberger, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Goldberger, and it's my privilege this morning to represent Tyrone Mitchell, who, of course, was the defendant below and is the appellant here. I'd like to reserve two of my 15 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you. Well, obviously, my guess is we'll go over, but Judge Roth does have an appointment today, so I won't be as usually long-winded as I am in the past. So we'll try to stay semi on time. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, my online arguments seem to have run on time, unlike standing at the podium. Judge Diamond sentenced Mr. Mitchell on a remand from this court to serve 895 months of imprisonment, which is nearly 75 years.
And he's how old, 54?
Mr. Mitchell at that time was 54 years old.
So Judge Diamond resentenced him.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes. The
question really for this comes down to, what is the legal status of a sentence that previously has been fully vacated? And as you know, there are circuits going both ways. What is the reason that you suggest that if it's fully vacated, that the First Step Act under 403B does apply?
Well, it's best, obviously, we start with two areas of law. One, of course, is the statutory language, and the other is the longstanding law of appellate jurisprudence, appellate mandates, and the two are in sync. So the section of the Sentencing Reform Act that talks about resentencing on remand is section 3742G. And that statute makes clear, I think, that Congress, looking at this particular problem, which section 403B of the First Step Act does not, understood that a sentencing would proceed, a resentencing after an appeal would proceed like an original sentencing. Says that the judge shall proceed under section 3553, except as otherwise directed by the mandate of the Court of Appeals.
Right, and G1 says that the judge shall apply the guidelines that were in effect on the date of the previous sentencing of the defendant prior to the appeal. Now that's subject to, you know, however the First Step Act changes those guidelines, but it's pegging the default law for this resentencing to what the law was at the original sentencing.
That was exactly the next thing I was going to say, and I think I would read that quite differently. That is, what it tells us is that the guidelines are to be, that were in effect at the time of the original sentencing, are to be used,
right,
unless the ex post facto clause dictates otherwise.
Right.
But not anything else.
I want to make a more basic point, which is there was a first sentencing.
Yes.
And then there's a vacater. And then it goes back for a second sentencing. But the second sentencing doesn't completely ignore the fact of the first sentencing. We're still pegging the default background law to what the law was the first time. We don't act as if the first sentencing had never happened.
We act as if the first sentencing had never happened, except as otherwise specifically prescribed. One is this unusual rule that was amended into the Sentencing Reform Act to use the guidelines.
Where does that come as the background rule rather than the exception? I mean, you can point to the First Step Act as creating an exception, certainly, but how does that become the default rule?
The clean slate principle that's articulated in so many appellate cases
in Pepper
and
for the law of the case purposes. Yes.
Yes.
But in Murphy, we interpreted Easter as joining the, quote, clear consensus among our sister circuits that a First Step Act resentencing is not a let's start all over. Judge Ambrose wrote that. Judge Roth joined it. So it's not a let's start all over. Doesn't that mean that we take some things as given? We don't refine all of the facts, for example. A judge may have some discretion or freedom to, but in Easter we said you don't have to have the defendant present. There are a number of things we do differently the second time around from the first time around.
Well, the defendant would have the right to file new objections to the pre-sentence report, ask that new facts be found. The government might or might not, depending on how the one bite at the apple rule was applied.
Okay, so the defendant can ask for these things, but if a defendant is not present at the first sentencing, it's just an error. But the defendant has to ask for it at the second one. The defendant can ask that certain facts be refound, but if the defendant doesn't do that, it's completely appropriate for the district court just to rely on the findings from that were made the first time. So it's not as if the first sentencing didn't happen. It happened, and it sets a different background and requires the defendant to ask or move for these things.
I think the sentencing judge has discretion, unless the terms of the mandate clearly require otherwise, to call for a new pre-sentence investigation or not. That's been my observation, and I don't disagree with that. The findings of fact begin with the pre-sentence investigation by the probation department. Yeah.
So let's talk about the statutory language.
Yes.
The first sentence is a sentence.
403B or 403, we're starting with 403A
or sentence, the sentence before our court's vacator.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is a sentence.
The sentence of imprisonment. I thought we were talking grammatically sentence. I misunderstood.
Is a criminal sentence, not
yes,
a grammatical
sentence. Yes, I got sentence. You. I got okay. you. I'm sorry.
I wasn't clear. Fair point. And that if we had asked Judge Diamond, 3 minutes after that, we would all have said that sentence has been imposed at that point. Now, I want to say yes. There's a distinct question about the vacator. But before it got up to our court, there's no question that a sentence has been imposed. Am I right? Am I right that the core meaning here is, does the vacator change what otherwise we all would have agreed is a sentence has been imposed?
Well, the vacator acts on the judgment, not on the sentence precisely. But yes,
you're saying the vacator acts on the judgment. So, and I mean, I think that's the way that Aviles and Hodge read what a sentence is. It doesn't have to be a final sentence. It doesn't have to be a sentence to survive appeal. It's not the sentence or the final sentence. And the sentence has been imposed. In Aviles and Hodge, we said it's the act of the district court. It's not the act of the court of appeals. So if I'm right, and tell me if I'm not right, then the case comes down to how we understand what the vacator does to the judgment.
Well, first of all, we have to read something into 403B. It's not just a sentence has been imposed. A sentence has been imposed on this count for this offense. We've already added words to make sense of it. It doesn't tell us everything that we need to know just reading the words of the statute. And in fact, that very same grammatical sentence of the statute says, shall apply to any offense that was committed. But of course, it doesn't mean any offense that was committed. It means any offense under section 924C. So we're interpreting and adding words to make sense of what it was clear that the drafters meant by this language. And one of the things that I think we can infer, and this is where I agree with the Seventh Circuit majority on bank, is that a hyper-literal reading, taking textualism, if you will, to an extreme on this language, just as pure language, doesn't get you to a correct understanding of the intent and meaning of the statute.
But that's the way, I mean, what I want to understand is what's different, because the way that we approached it in Aviles and Hodge was a pretty literal approach. So where, how do you read, how should we best read what it means for there to be a sentence that's been imposed, or how should we read the vacator?
The vacator, I'm sorry, was I echoing or was someone else
asking? You echoed.
Oh, sorry. The vacator vacates the judgment and remands the case for a new sentencing. It treats the sentence as if it had not been imposed for this purpose. It puts the defendant in the position that Congress, in the category of people where Congress drew what is clearly a compromise line between the default rule against retroactive application of new criminal penalties in Section 109 and a fully retroactive provision, which could be used in and of itself as a justification for a post-conviction attack on a 10-year-old sentence under this statute. And Congress picked a fair middle ground.
It's interesting that you use that phrase as if. I'm trying to remember which, but I thought I thought a different provision of the First Step Act, was it 404B, uses the as if language? I mean, it's used elsewhere in the First Step Act, but they don't use it in this section.
That's true.
So I think it's a little odd to read as if in here when the very same bill uses it in a different retroactivity provision.
I would agree with you were the phenomenon of a resentencing after a vacator of the first sentence an ordinary case. But this is an unusual and rare instance, a circumstance that you could not assume Congress would anticipate and write a specific provision for, or write its words to anticipate. And so the question is, what was Congress intending for people like Mr. Mitchell, like someone who was sentenced 10 years ago and is trying to take advantage of the First Step Act collaterally, or is he like someone who, for one reason or another, his sentence was delayed through litigation or whatever, and is coming up to be sentenced?
So we have a potentially unanticipated situation here.
Yes.
And I guess some of it depends on the background rule. Now, in many criminal cases, we approach that background rule through the rule of lenity, but shouldn't we read Dorsey as suggesting a different background rule? Dorsey says, the Supreme Court says, look, you know, if Congress wants to make this retroactive, it's got to say it. You know, at common law, traditionally, changes in criminal penalties are prospective. We respect finality. So if we're going to upset the apple cart for other sentences, we're going to make it clear when they kick in already. Now,
Dorsey is clearly the most similar.
Right. Dorsey is similar. And so for many of these provisions, some of the provisions key it to finality. There are parts like 403A that key it to whether it's a final sentence. But we said in Hodge, 403B doesn't say the sentence has to be final. The sentence just has to be imposed. So if the Dorsey background principle is we leave sentences alone unless we're told not to leave them alone, then how do you overcome it here with this general appeal to intent?
Well, first, I would start by saying that Hodge is very weak precedent because it is so overbroad relative to the case before the panel at that time and the entire discussion that we're focusing on here in relation to Mr. Mitchell's case was entirely unnecessary to the decision.
It was an alternative holding, you know, and a panel has a decision as to how broadly or narrowly to write, but this was part of the reasoning supporting that alternative holding. And of course, the panel carved out from its holding our precise situation,
yes,
but its reasoning still deserves our respect. What are we supposed to do with that reason?
Compare it to Dorsey and and to a careful focus on people in the few people that are in Mr. Mitchell's position, and ask whether he is one of the people who Congress intended to be just short of being saved from falling off this cliff. There's going to be a cliff one way or another. There's a date before which and after which the rule doesn't apply for sure. And the difference for him is between a sentence that he can survive, a 25-year sentence, potentially the shortest possible sentence, and the 65 or 75-year sentence.
Look, the equities have some play here. A lot of people think these sentences are too long. That's definitely a fair point to make. But when you talk about cliffs, what I think of is Hodge saying, look, there's going to be a cliff somewhere, and we're concerned about the cliff between the person who just happens to get a vacator, but not a vacator, yeah, in that situation, the person who happens to have the resentencing and the person who doesn't. So it seems arbitrary. Now, maybe you can distinguish Hodge a different way. I mean, Hodge, it was on non-924C counts rather than 924C, but, mm-hmm, but the particular cliff that Hodge was more concerned about was two different co-defendants, and one of them happens to have a case sent back, and it seemed arbitrary to the panel and Hodge to create that cliff. So right, you've got a cliff to point to,
but there's
a
different cliff to here. You can hypothesize an exactly parallel case for Mr. Mitchell, I did in my brief, where one co-defendant comes up for an original sentencing at a different time than another. I don't think the imagining the scenario of unfairness gets you anywhere, because the world is full of strange stories, and you can make one up for any.
So if the cliff doesn't cut either direction, why is your saying Congress meant it or intended it to apply to him ultimately based on a kind of lenity, these sentences generally are too high principle? And then how does that fit with Dorsey and preserving finality? I'm not finality, but just repose of imposed, yeah, sentences.
Well, we do have a clue from the title of the section, which is that Congress described it, however oddly, as a clarification, which does put the weight of intent behind saying we want this to be carried out. And I admit I'm reading tea leaves here, but when I see Congress saying clarification and then choosing this middle ground, not the 109 rule, but the middle ground of for people who happen to be coming up for sentencing anyway, Mr. Mitchell is more like those people in terms of congressional, what we seem to think, and what I think Congress was trying to intend by this partial reform. I am well over my time, and I want to be sure to say that I would hope the court will look at the last two points of my brief, the failure to give a reason and the substantive reasonableness of the choice that was made for the length of this sentence.
On the other point, yes. I do want to ask, is the retroactivity argument for, you know, the counts 1 and 15, that's going to stand or fall with this one, right?
It's
the same,
right,
language we're looking.
That's right. And because it only applies to two of the four counts like that, I don't intend to use any of my time on my second or third arguments, because they don't affect the package.
my final question is, before we go to Mr. Zosmer, how ambiguous does the statute need to be for the rule of lenity to come into play? Because the cases that we've looked at really don't, even though they too go your way, a precedential en banc opinion and not precedential opinion of the Fourth Circuit, which I suspect may have started off as a precedential opinion, versus the Sixth Circuit of Jackson. Mm-hmm. But how ambiguous must the statute be before the rule of lenity comes into play?
Favorite question of mine. I mean, there are two conflicting lines of Supreme Court authority that do not refer to one another. I'm sure Judge Bevis knows this very well, having done a lot of work on lenity. One of which talks about grievous ambiguity, and the other of which does not. And it's not that one has superseded the other, but I will say that the grievous ambiguity cases come from nowhere. The earliest cases that mention it, I think, are all by Chief Justice Rehnquist, and the term comes into some of those cases without prior authority at all, and are not consistent with the grounding of the rule of lenity, which going back decades and decades before the Rehnquist court. I think the right rule is that the ordinary tools of statutory construction don't give the court confidence that you have reached the intended meaning of the statute. You can use a tiebreaker rule like lenity. I think constitutional avoidance is another such rule, but lenity comes into play at that point for the two reasons that the rule of lenity exists: to protect the separation of powers, to prevent overreaching by judges into the legislative realm, and to protect the due process rights of defendants, never to be sentenced more harshly than it is clear the legislature intended.
Okay. Well,
for that very long answer to that question, but
I'm just not sure if due process notice applies where he clearly had notice if the First Step Act hadn't come along. This really then comes down to a more separation of powers of what did Congress intend or clearly mm-hmm. signal.
Yes, fair enough.
Do you have any questions?
No, I don't.
Okay, then we'll get Mr. Zosmer up, and then Mr. Goldberger, we'll get you back on rebuttal.
Great, thank you very much. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Robert Zosmer on behalf of the government. Very nice to see all of you. It looks like you're doing well. I hope that's the case. The question presented here with regard to Section 403 is a straightforward question of statutory interpretation. I don't take a great deal of pleasure in saying this, given the facts of the case, but it's not a particularly difficult question of statutory interpretation. We always start with the statutory language.
If it wasn't difficult, why do really bright people, one court having 12 people in bank, and you got six other people in other courts, so you've got 18 people going different ways?
Well, first of all, we have no court going a different way in this particular situation, where a sentence was in existence when the First Step Act was passed and then was vacated later. But I do agree that the Uriarte case does have language that pushes against our position here. I think it's motivated, and I don't question this at all, by the really draconian situation that we face. But this situation is really not unique to Mr. Mitchell, and the real concern, and I'm happy to talk about this in more detail later, is really with regard to thousands of other people whose sentences were not vacated and are in this situation of serving sentences that are dramatically longer than would be imposed under current law. And the reason they are is because of the decision that Congress made. Fundamentally, what we have here, and I know your honors know this well, fundamentally what we have is a decision that is committed to Congress as to whether to make its changes in sentencing law retroactive. We have a default principle. It's in Section 109, which says it's not retroactive, that as a general rule, if Congress changes a criminal penalty, that change does not apply retroactively, and that there needs to be an express statement if that rule is not to be followed. Now, and so that's the key question here, and we're given this very clear language. In looking back just over the last 10 years, we have different examples of how Congress approaches this problem. The first time it comes up in recent history is when it passes the Fair Sentencing Act in 2010, which, as you know very, very well, changes the penalties for crack cocaine offenses. And at that time, the Supreme Court in Dorsey, really endorsing the view of this circuit, the court in Dorsey finds a particular declaration by Congress. What it says, look, we know the default principle is that the change doesn't apply retroactively. But what rules the day in Dorsey is that the Fair Sentencing Act said, we direct the Sentencing Commission to immediately change its guidelines. And so the court read that as an express statement that the Fair Sentencing Act should apply at least to those people who had not yet been sentenced. And so it enforces the strict rule against anybody who had been sentenced before. The Fair Sentencing Act did not apply to them. But it did apply to the people who were sentenced afterwards. Then comes the First Step Act in 2018 with regard to that same provision, the Fair Sentencing Act. And now Congress takes a different tack. In Section 404, it says people are eligible for reconsideration of their sentence as if the Fair Sentencing Act was in effect at the time. Now, this court has had many opportunities to address that. And what it has made clear is that what as if means is that we take the Fair Sentencing Act and its provisions regarding crack sentencing, we insert them into the previous assessment, but everything else stays the same. That's default rule still exists. With regard to sections 401 and 403, we have yet another model. And again, this is all up to Congress. And Congress gives this very clear language that says it doesn't apply retroactively if a sentence for the offense has not been imposed. Now, I know there's an interesting legal question here as to what does vacating a sentence mean and what ordinary impact does that have? But this language is not focused on that at all. It's a very clear statement that if someone has had a sentence imposed, that this act is not applying retroactively. The default provision is in existence with regard to those people. I take no pleasure in saying this. There's no question that Mr. Mitchell's sentence would be significantly lower. He is among, as my good friend Mr. Goldberger says, he is among a very small number of people. It's the only case in this circuit that I know of that's in this situation where his sentence was vacated later on appeal, because of course, most people's sentences don't get vacated later on appeal. But he's in a group, in an extremely large group of people who had a sentence imposed before the First Step Act was applied. Under Section 401, there are people serving life sentences that are not being reduced. Under Section 403, there are people serving 100-year sentences that are not being reduced. This is a matter for Congress. They made their decision in the First Step Act in 401 and 403. There's actually a bill pending right now. It's called the First Step Act Implementation Act. It was introduced by Senator Durbin, and I believe it's been reported out of the Senate Judiciary Committee that would make retroactive sections 401 and 403. And if I recall correctly, the First Step Implementation Act simply copies that language, the as-if language from 404, and thus it'll have the same effect going forward. Should that happen, should that be passed, I think you can tell from my language, you will hear no complaint from me, and I'm sure many of my colleagues, that we will take the time necessary to go back and address these sentences. But again, what we're dealing here with, I don't have much to add to what has been said by many other courts, and certainly by Judge Smith and his colleagues in the Hodge case.
The question becomes, what is the legal status of a sentence that has been fully vacated? Is it a legal nullity, or is it still, quote, a sentence, close quote?
With all respect, Judge Ambrose, I just don't think it's the right question for this case. The legal effect, certainly, of a vacated sentence is that sentence is no longer enforceable. It must be reimposed by a district court. But what we're dealing here with is Congress is not making a declaration here as to the effect of vacated sentences. It's making a declaration as to—
Yeah, you're relying on the statutory interpretation, and yet 9-3 on the Seventh Circuit, nine judges in Uriarte are saying that 403B is not ambiguous. And I'm sitting there, well, maybe that's the case, but that's what nine say. It's not ambiguous. They give other reasons. And you're saying it's not ambiguous, but the other way. And my question to Mr. Goldberger and to you, how ambiguous must a statute be before the rule of lenity comes into play?
Well, two things, Your Honor. First, in Uriarte, the situation is that a sentence was imposed and then vacated before the First Step Act was passed. And so at the time the First Step Act comes into existence, that person is not facing a sentence. I think there could still be an argument as to whether it's correct that you can say no sentence was ever imposed, but it's a very different situation from what we have here. And that's what the Sixth Circuit
says. And my question on that is, does it matter? Well, isn't it a vacated sentence a legal nullity? I mean, and Pepper says, you know, the slate is wiped clean.
Well, the Sixth Circuit, you know, has addressed both sides of the coin. And the Sixth Circuit in Jackson, having earlier held that in the Uriarte situation, that this does not apply, this does apply retroactively, that in our situation, where sentence is in existence but vacated after the First Step Act, it does not. And I think may have been Judge Baer in dissent, I acknowledge, in Uriarte, but someone said correctly.
It was her dissent, yes.
Right, it correctly said that, sure, it may be a nullity going forward, it may wipe the slate clean going forward, but it's not a time machine. It doesn't just wipe out the historic fact that a sentence was imposed looking at the language. With respect to Your Honor's question regarding the rule of lenity, I'm not as quick as Mr. Goldberger to say that we can ignore the numerous Supreme Court decisions that have told us that there has to be a grievous ambiguity. But I think we do have common ground in understanding that the rule of lenity does not simply reflexively apply, that there has to be, after using all tools of statutory interpretation, there has to be an ambiguity. And in this case—
In considering the rule of lenity, can we consider the purpose of the statute?
Yeah, certainly. Because again, we have to consider all the rules of statutory interpretation, and that certainly Judge Roth is one of them. But my submission here respectfully is that we don't get past the first rule of statutory interpretation, which is to look at the plain language of the statute. And that's what's controlling. And also going back to—
But in looking at the plain language of the statute, in considering the object of the statute, is the plain language of the statute really plain?
Well, the object, and this is something I've spoken of earlier, the object is clearly not to apply this statute generally retroactively. That's really—
The object is not to apply sentences that are so long that there's no possibility of the prisoner ever completing the sentence.
Right. I mean, we have here two very clear objects from Congress. One is to significantly ameliorate the penalties going forward and dramatically lower the penalties and not afford that to people who had a sentence imposed earlier. Mr. Mitchell, unfortunately, falls into that first group and not into the second group. That's the decision that Congress made. I could get into the math here. I'm sure the court can do it as well. He actually is not one of the more prejudiced people because he's going to be 56 years old this month. And if he were sentenced even under current law, based on Judge Diamond's view of the case and imposing the guideline maximum, he's looking at an effective life sentence regardless, no matter how many counts there are, no matter which law you're applying. But there are, like I said, there are thousands of other people where Congress made a decision. Getting back to the key point here, Judge Roth, I'll allude to the Aviles decision that I haven't mentioned, which involves Section 401. Judge Roth, of course, you were on that panel. And what Judge Rendell wrote there is that, quote, imposition and finality are two different concepts. And I think that's the most straightforward answer I can give to the question that Judge Ambrose has sensibly been pressing as to, you know, how does vacatur play into this? It doesn't play into the very clear statutory language that Congress used.
Judge Bibas, you have any questions on that issue? Do you want to address the interrogatories and instruction
issue? Sure. Well, that issue, Your Honor, affects only one count. It only affects count one.
Count 15 or?
I believe it only affects count one, which was the conspiracy charge. And on that charge, there was a 10-year mandatory. There is also a 10-year mandatory, as Your Honor suggests, on count 7 and count 15. And so the first answer is, it really doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the guideline range. It affects the 10-year mandatory, and the court elected to impose a concurrent 235-month sentence on all non-924C counts. It's subject to review for plain error. There was no objection to the instructions at trial. There was actually no objection to the quantity finding of the jury, even on resentencing, on the basis that Mr. Goldberger is now presenting. there was a totally different argument that was presented, that the conspiracy quantity was wrong because it aggregated all of the offenses. That's not what's being argued now. What's being suggested now is that there was a mistake in the attribution instruction. There wasn't, for the reasons that we lay out in our brief, but even if there was, you, for numerous reasons, we submit you can't show a reasonable probability that the jury would have reached a different finding had it been given additional instructions. To suggest that, Mr. Goldberger suggests in his brief that essentially the jury would have rejected Mr. Jenkins' testimony, the co-conspirator. They didn't not only reject Mr. Jenkins' testimony, that was the key basis of the verdict. He was the key witness. There's no reason to think, he testified to repeatedly, week after week, buying thousands of dollars worth of cocaine from Mr. Mitchell, often on credit. There's simply no reason to think that any jury was gonna find that less than 500 grams of cocaine was involved. So there, that's a long answer, but it's count one, it doesn't matter, and there really was no error.
One final question that I have in connection with the Section 841A offense. If the First Step Act were to apply, and that any incarceration from his supervised release violations are attributable to this 1995 drug offense, do we still need to remand so the district court can determine if the 6 weeks of custody in connection with the supervised release violation was in fact served as incarceration?
Well, that would be one option. I mean, this is yet again another issue that was not raised in the district court. There was a very vague objection based on the serious, I think it's page 289 of the appendix, this vague objection to using the conviction on the 15-year rule, but no argument at all related to that violation of supervised release, which is really what triggers the 15-year rule being satisfied here. If Section 401 were to apply retroactively, which of course we say it does not, this is completely an issue of first impression, both legally and factually. There's no court decision that I'm aware of that addresses the effect of a violation of supervised release sentence with regard to the 15-year provision. And there's no factual determination in this case because the issue just wasn't raised. So yes, I guess this court would have the option of remanding, but we don't believe that that's appropriate. And again, it doesn't have a material impact on the sentence.
All right, thank you. Any further questions of my colleagues?
No.
No.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Zosmer. Mr. Goldberger, on rebuttal.
Very briefly on the Section 851 issue about the 15-year rule, it was raised.
Is it 851 or 841? I'm sorry.
851. 851 is the notice provision which affects the extent of the statute of the penalty under 841. So it's both. It's both. But I cited in the brief the place where it was raised in the record. It was raised sufficiently. The government failed to offer proof. This is a clear instance in which the one bite at the apple rule would apply. There would be a remand to reduce the sentence, not a remand for the government to reopen and offer new evidence. But more important on the 403B issue. First, as to the Implementation Act, I'm not sure what point Mr. Zosmer is making. Certainly the court should not wait for Congress, but in any event, who knows what, if anything, Congress will accomplish on any subject. But if that provision were passed, I think people would have the same opportunity to file a motion and in the judge's discretion obtain a reduction. It would not be a de novo sentencing as Mr. Mitchell is entitled to, so it wouldn't even be the same relief. But the more important point is the one that Judge Roth raised, which is the purpose of the statute. The government has reiterated here the tautological argument that they made in their brief, that the object of the sentence is to restrict the extent of retroactivity. That's not the object of the sentence.
I don't think that's quite fair. I think Mr. Zosmer is making the point that no statute pursues one object at all costs. It's a compromise, it's a trade-off. As I understand it, the First Step Act was a bipartisan act, and one thing you do to build a bipartisan coalition to build bring people online and say, okay, we'll give people a break going forward, and for 404B for crack sentences, and we'll give them something going backwards, but we're not going to upset the apple cart for all the people who are currently serving sentences. So I think point is, it was a measured, it was, we'll give some benefit, but not an unlimited benefit to everybody. And that's, I mean, that's consistent with the way we read it in Avila's and Hotch.
Yes, and I think that's what I said in my principal argument, which is that there's a compromise, and Mr. Mitchell is one of those who is on the side of the line in the unusual subcategory. I accept that it might even be a virtually unique category of people who are just on the side of the line, of those who should be viewed as a going forward, not a looking backward case. So with that, I ask that you reverse and remand for resentencing. I reiterate my suggestion that if there's going to be a second remand, it'd be to a different judge who would be open to imposing a sentence, who might be open to imposing a sentence where Mr. Mitchell
That's a very
could,
unusual.
Could reach the end of the sentence.
Wait a second, Mr. Goldberger, we are pretty reluctant, absent some demonstrable bias or the like. Is there any evidence of, you know, intemperate bias or appearance of bias in this record that would justify that kind of rebuke to Judge Diamond here?
Bias is not required for a remand to another judge under
21. It's not required, but our practice, it's a pretty unusual measure for us. So why should we take that step?
I would view it not as a rebuke at all, but as a protection against being put in the difficult and embarrassing position that he would be in on a third resentencing. For the it protects the appearance of justice, and in I would focus here on my fourth argument, that the complete failure to give any semblance of a reason, no token compliance with the 3551C obligation to give a reason for selecting a higher sentence. The time has come for a new view.
I would push back on that. I think Judge Diamond did give reasons, saying about three reasons that I can think of at the sentencing as to why he believed, despite the fact this man was 54 at the time, that he was not going to quit. He was just, if he was back out on the street, he'd be back at it. This has been his career, legal career, I should say, in terms of getting into trouble. And he gave reasons. Now, you can disagree with those.
No, those are reasons for a harsh sentence. The question is why the higher sentence within the wide guideline range, the whole guideline range, is harsh. The question, what he did not address at all, is the special reasons requirement that this statute imposes for particularly long sentences where the judge
we have this presumption of reasonableness for within range sentences? Is the same level of explanation required?
Third Circuit does not have a presumption of reasonableness for within range sentences. We rejected that on bank at the very beginning of this line of authority.
I think of a single case within guidelines in the Third Circuit where a court has reversed.
Olhofsky.
Which one?
Olhofsky. It's not otherwise similar, but yes, there are such cases. There are a couple of cases.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both of you. It's a real privilege to have both of you back before us. I would ask that a transcript be prepared of this oral argument. And Mr. Zosmer, would it be okay if the government picked up the tab for that?
We'll be happy to, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Again, a pleasure.